It's Thursday, October 10, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Time and again, we find ourselves observing that scientific studies come out to tell us what we already know, or already ought to know. But that doesn't mean the studies aren't interesting and significant in themselves. An example of that came out yesterday. The Pew Research Center found that American parents are working hard at being parents, but are also happier at being parents than many had understood. As the Washington Post reports, ever since the federal government began collecting detailed surveys a decade ago of how Americans spend their time, that's known as the American Time Use Survey, those reports have shown that mothers, even those who work full-time, spend about twice as much time as fathers taking care of kids and cleaning up around the house. Fathers spend more time at work and in leisure, according to the study. Now, for the first time, the survey is asking parents how they feel about that. Mothers, here's the big scientific release, feel exhausted. The Pew Research Center found that mothers are more wiped out, they're more exhausted than fathers in four major arenas of life. Those are work, housework, childcare, and leisure. But here's where the study gets even more interesting, because after all, I think most people would have figured that out. Mothers are also happier than fathers while working, caring for children, and doing leisure activities. This in terms of how mothers and fathers are reporting on their relative happiness while engaged in these endeavors. Nearly twice as many mothers as fathers say they're even very happy doing housework. If you're following this fascinating scientific breakthrough in this report, there's more. It turns out that, as the Washington Post summarizes, far more mothers consider housework meaningful while more fathers are stressed out by it. For our consideration, perhaps the most important issue is, as Wendy Wang reports for the Pew Research Center, as parents are spending more time with kids, they're actually finding that time more rewarding than their paid work. It's more exhausting on the one hand, but on the other hand, parents are reflecting a great deal of satisfaction from parenting their children, the time they spend with their children, engaging in life with their children, even involved in intensive child care responsibilities. It turns out that there's something inherently rewarding about parenting. That's true for both fathers and mothers. According to this research, more mothers say so than fathers, but still, a sizable number of both fathers and mothers are saying, "This is really where I find my greatest enjoyment." There's a lot in this rather massive study of social and demographic trends to deserve our attention, but the most important thing is this. From a Christian worldview perspective, we of all people should not be surprised that in the context of the family and in the relationship of parenting, both mothers and fathers find great satisfaction when they're spending time with their children. Why would that be so? Well, for one thing, we need to note that as secular observers on the family have been writing for the better part of a quarter century or more, they've been suggesting that parents are finding parenting less satisfying than in the past. We should have no surprise that there are complications faced by parents, both mothers and fathers, in dealing with their children, all kinds of complexities having to do with changes in the economy and changes in the society. But when it comes to the actual enjoyment of the relationship and even of the responsibilities of parenthood, it turns out that mothers and fathers are saying, "This is where I find enjoyment." But they're saying more. They're saying, "This is where I find my greater enjoyment than even in my paid employment." This no doubt is reflected in a great deal of the argument, even controversy, you hear amongst American feminists arguing about whether women should lean in or lean back when it comes to the work environment, arguing that women who find greater fulfillment in the family context are letting down the team, as one feminist put it. But this study also has a great deal to say to men and a conversation that ought to be going on amongst husbands and fathers. And it comes down to this: the expectation that a man can find his greatest enjoyment in his job, opposed to finding enjoyment with his children, his wife, and his family, it turns out that that's not paying off. Furthermore, as Christian dads are considering this, we need to understand that if there is a monomaniacal commitment to work at the expense of the family, it's not just hurting the family, it's even robbing that father of the joy of spending the time with his children. A stunning 62% of parents said that they found childcare, the responsibilities of tending and caring for children, to be very meaningful. Was there a downside to this responsibility? Of course. Both fathers and mothers said they are exhausted, and mothers even more than fathers. But you have to wonder, is this exhaustion a new development? If we understood how mothers and fathers felt at the turn of the century, at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, or back during the agrarian age, would they have been less exhausted? Perhaps this research also ought to remind us that we should be careful in measuring perception, our own perception and the perception of others. Because, after all, how do we know what it means for parents to say that they're stressed out, or tired, or exhausted, as compared with any previous generation. There are reasons to expect that this is a stressed-out generation, but here's the good news. Even stressed-out parents are finding great satisfaction in taking care of their children. As we noted in last week's social science research indicating that marriage is really important for the family getting ahead, two is better than one, according to that report. Well, now we have a similar report. And as in the previous, we have to ask this question. Whose idea was this? The same Creator God who loved us enough to give us the institution of the family also gave us the relationship of parenthood. And whose idea do you think it was that parents should find such great fulfillment in taking care of their children? And speaking of research reports, a blockbuster report came out yesterday released by the Institute for American Values. The headline in the report is this: New York's Promise, Why Sponsoring Casinos is a Regressive Policy Unworthy of a Great State. The report by the Institute for American Values comes even as the citizens of New York are going to be asked to vote in November about legalizing casino gambling and expanding it within their state. As James Adato of the Albany Times Union reports, few things are clear about the question of casinos in New York, but additional slot machines will add significantly to problem gambling and may not be economically rewarding for the state. That, according to this report that is out from the Institute for American Values. What's more interesting than the report is the response to it. And indeed, Odato's article in the Times Union of Albany, New York, remember that's New York's capital, makes that point graphically. In coming days, we'll be taking a closer look at the IAV report, but what's most important is its bottom line. The increase in casino gambling will lead to very serious damaging effects within the state of New York, particularly damaging effects on those who are already damaged, those who are economically least privileged and least powerful. It turns out that casino gambling is predatory, and we know this, upon the poorest segments of society. And here are a couple of statistics to make that point clear. These casinos draw 40 to 60% of their income from slot machine revenues. That means the very form of gambling found in these casinos that is most predatory amongst the poorest is where these casinos get their greatest gains. And, as it turns out, the IAV report makes the point that is already just mathematically clear, and that is, the more you risk, the more you lose. The state of New York is actually now going to turn on its own citizens to prey upon them by enticing them into casinos and basically fleecing them, robbing them. It is the most regressive tax. As one previous report made very clear, this is a tax on the less intelligent, those who actually believe that they will be an individual exception to the laws of math. And, of course, it doesn't work out. Casinos only make money if most of the people coming in lose rather than win. And the more they come in and the more they gamble, the more they lose, the more the casinos win. What does the state of New York get out of this? Tax revenue. Revenue from these casinos, and as there have been falling taxes into the coffers of states, several states, not just New York, are looking at ways to try to increase their revenue, and the temptation to turn to casinos is very powerful. Remember that the organization that released this report is the Institute for American Values. In response to this report, the spokesman for the American Gaming Association, that's the industry lobbying association, says, quote, "They believe their values are better than others. They're trying to throw the baby out with the bathwater," end quote. Amazingly enough, here you have the spokesman for the casino industry saying that those who criticize the predatory actions of casinos think that their values are better than others, the others presumably being those who are actually owning and operating the casinos. And in that case, virtually all Americans will probably say, even if they actually gamble themselves, yes, the values of the others are better than the values of the casinos. You might think that a spokesperson for the casino industry would be a little more circumspect about trying to argue on the ground of morality and values, but this man doesn't give up. Jeff Freeman, the president of the American Gaming Association, comes back and says, quote, "What's wrong with this," meaning the report, "is that the Institute for American Values is saying what American values are. They leave no stone unturned trying to lay blame on the feet of casinos," end quote. Of course, missing from Mr. Freeman's statement is any hint of exactly what the values of the gaming industry might be. He tried to downplay the pathological significance of gambling, arguing that just 1% of the U.S. population has a pathological addiction to gambling. The other 99%, he said, should have the entertainment they desire. It's very interesting here that the casino gambling industry is presenting itself as a form of entertainment. The Gaming Association's own research claims that only 2 to 3% of the adult population are having gambling problems. It's not clear how they define problems. Mr. Freeman claims that the members of his association get most of their revenue from whales, those big gamblers who can afford their spending. He said the average debt of a pathological gambler isn't enormous, about $5,000. Let's just pause there. Who are these people who are identified as pathological gamblers who have the supposedly not enormous debt of about $5,000? Well, a quick look at how these things actually stack up indicate that these, in many cases, are those who can least afford this kind of indebtedness and may never get out of it. And the real victims here are the children and families who aren't getting fed and the mortgages that aren't getting paid because of the gambling habits of one or more members of the family and the debts that are accruing. Polls indicate that it's likely that New York voters will approve the expansion of casino gambling. Why? Because if you offer this kind of income for the state, where people think they might have a break on their taxes, they'll let someone else pay the bills. This means that citizens in many states appear to be willing to prey on their own neighbors when it comes to the expansion or the legalization of casino gambling. How's that as a moral value? Over the weekend, an article appeared in the New York Times. It simply demands our attention. It's by Gregory Burns, who is a professor at Emory University in Atlanta. He's identified as a professor of neuroeconomics and the author of the book entitled How Dogs Love Us, A Neuroscientist and His Adopted Dog Decode the Canine Brain. The headline in the story in the New York Times is this: Dogs Are People Too. That's not just a headline. That's an amazing, even an astounding moral claim. But it's made straightforwardly in the pages of the New York Times. Gregory Burns writes, "For the past 2 years, my colleagues and I have been training dogs to go in an MRI scanner, completely awake and unrestrained. Our goal has been to determine how dogs' brains work and, even more important, what they think of us humans." His next paragraph is an absolute stunner. Quote, "Now, after training and scanning a dozen dogs, my one inescapable conclusion is this: dogs are people, too." Well, perhaps our one inescapable question is why the New York Times would run an article like this, claiming that dogs are people, too, based upon one scientist's supposed research on a dozen dogs. But if you're wondering how this research just might be carried out and whether or not it's credible, just consider this paragraph. Quote, "From the beginning, we treated the dogs as persons. We had a consent form, which was modeled after a child's consent form, but signed by the dog's owner. We emphasized that participation was voluntary and that the dog had the right to quit the study. We used only positive training methods, no sedation, no restraints. If the dogs didn't want to be in the MRI scanner, they could leave, same as any human volunteer." End quote. Well, how incredibly broad-minded and how stupidly insane. What in the world does it mean for dogs to supposedly have consent, or in any meaningful way, to have consent given by their owner? By the way, hold that thought, because Gregory Burns really doesn't think they should be owners anyway. What does it mean for dogs supposedly to be voluntary participants in such a study, and that they had the right to quit the study? Are we assuming that these dogs had any understanding of what was going on? Was there informed consent in any way, like would be expected of a human patient, so that they understood exactly what's going on and the purpose for the experiment? Of course not. It's because dogs aren't persons. They're not even close to being persons. Dogs are wonderful creatures. They reflect the glory of God in their very dogness. But the one thing that becomes abundantly clear from a biblical worldview is that humans are humans and other animals are not. The confusion over this is not only toxic, it's absolutely insane. It leads to the kinds of arguments you find amongst persons who tried to argue, even going to the United States Supreme Court, that whales held in captivity are actually a form of slaves. They are in a form of slavery, just like human slavery going back to the 19th century and beyond. Looking more closely at the actual research, this professor and his colleagues claim to have been able to study 12 dogs in an MRI machine. And what they found is described as the striking similarity between dogs and humans in both the structure and function of a key brain region, the caudate nucleus. Are you still with me? Burns writes, quote, "Rich in dopamine receptors, the caudate sits between the brainstem and the cortex. In humans, the caudate plays a key role in the anticipation of things we enjoy, like food, love, and money. But can we flip this association around and infer what a person is thinking just by measuring caudate activity? Because," he writes, "of the overwhelming complexity of how different parts of the brain are connected to one another, it's not usually possible to pin a single cognitive function or emotion to a single brain region." Which, we insert at this point, would seem to mean that this article is meaningless even by the standards of its own author. But then he goes on, quote, "But the caudate may be an exception. Specific parts of the caudate stand out for their consistent activation to many things that humans enjoy. Caudate activation is so consistent that under the right circumstances, it can predict our preferences for food, music, and even beauty." End quote. Well, the bottom line in this research is that Burns and his colleagues claim that the same area of the brain lights up for both dogs and humans, indicating that we must be exactly the same. Bioethicist Wesley J. Smith, looking at this, makes the obvious point. Anyone who's ever watched a dog eat knows that dogs are happy and excited about eating. Furthermore, given the relationship between humans and dogs, we shouldn't be surprised that we both enjoy greeting one another and spending time with one another. That doesn't mean that we are the same. The bigger worldview issue that's going on here is physicalism, the attempt to reduce human beings to merely physical form and physical processes. In other words, that we are nothing more than our brains and the enzymes and chemicals that make our brains work. Of course, this points to another realization, and that is, if you're operating from a truly secular worldview, physicalism simply goes with it. You can't avoid a physicalist assumption if you deny anything beyond secular reality. That's why in this society right now, there are so many people who appear to be confused about whether or not humans are just animals like other animals, all other animals. Burns goes on in his article published in the New York Times over the weekend to argue for, quote, a sort of limited personhood for animals, end quote. He actually wants full personhood, but he doesn't think we're ready for that yet. He says if we did take a step further and we did grant dogs the rights of personhood, they would be afforded additional protection against exploitation. Of course, if they really were recognized as persons, they could sue us. Or for that matter, they could own us. We could be their pets rather than dogs being our pets. Burns concludes his article, quote, perhaps someday we may see a case arguing for a dog's rights based on brain imaging findings, end quote. Well, when that day comes, understand we are in big trouble. A society that begins to believe that dogs, or for that matter, whales or porpoises or hens or amoebas are people too, is a society that is actually lowering humans to the level of animals, not raising animals to the status of humans. Speaking of pets or animals and confusion, several newspapers are reporting on the blessing of the animal services held in at least some churches in recent days. The reason for that might be that October the 4th is on the sacramental and liturgical calendar, the feast day of St. Francis of Assisi, identified as the patron saint of animals, and now, by the way, in many churches, identified as the patron saint of animals and ecology. One example of this kind of story is by Jenna Isery, published in the Courier-Journal of Louisville, Kentucky, although the story is about a city right across the river, and that is New Albany, Indiana. As she reports, dogs, birds, a guinea pig, a python, and a blue-tongued skink attended the 10 a.m. service at St. Paul's Episcopal Church on Sunday, spilling into the aisle or sitting on their owner's laps. The pets, some exotic but most run-of-the-mill varieties, were present for the annual blessing of the animals in conjunction with the Feast of St. Francis. Let's be very clear about what's going on here. People are bringing their animals, their pets, into a worship service in order for these animals to be blessed. Cindy Wood brought a cockatoo in addition to a ball python and a blue-tongued skink. Quote, it doesn't quite feel like we've hit St. Francis Day unless we're recognizing the animals. They're part of the community, too, even if they're not seen as much, end quote. Well, let's just pause here. Part of what community? Part of the worshiping community? Well, in the sense that all creation testifies of the glory of the Creator. But in terms of conscious worship, they are not a part of the worshiping community. Here again, we see a grotesque distortion and confusion, but one that seems to be increasingly common. According to the report in the Courier-Journal, the service was punctuated with yips, whines, and barks, but no one seemed to mind. Wood sang with the choir, with her ball python draped over her shoulders and curling around her neck. Let's just pause for a moment and realize this is a straightforward article meant to be written and read with a straight face, supposedly perhaps edited with a straight face, arguing that in a church service, there is a woman singing in the choir with a ball python wrapped around her neck. And this church, again, it's the St. Paul's Episcopal Church in New Albany, Indiana. It followed the service with Barktoberfest, a combination animal fair and Oktoberfest in the church's carriage house. A final note in the news story, it had to be moved inside, that is Barktoberfest, because even though they like to hold it outside, rain prevented the event from being held outdoors. What's really going on here? This is not the kind of heresy that raises to the level of the denial of the Christian faith. This is just one of those practices that indicates the depth of a theological confusion over the issue of worship, the purpose of worship, and a theological confusion over the distinction between humans and animals. It's not wrong to pray for the Creator to bless his animal creatures, but to bring them to church, to wrap a python around the neck, is to make very clear that there is a basic confusion here, not only about worship, not only about the animals, not only about humans, but about God and the worship he both requires and accepts. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.